Welcome and thank you for standing by. All participants will be on a listen-only mode for the duration of today's conference. This conference is now being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. We will be conducting a question-and-answer session today. If you would like to ask a question, you may press star, then one. I would now like to turn the conference over to Kathy Harbin with the CDC Office of Communication. Thank you. You may begin.
Thank you, Karen, and thank you all for joining us for an update on the Zika virus outbreak. With us today are the Director of CDC, Dr. Tom Frieden, as well as Dr. Denise Jamison, and that's Jamison, Dr. Paul Meade, and that's Mead, and Dr. Julie Villanueva, that's Villanueva. We are also joined by Dr. Luciana Borio, B-O-R-I-O, and she is with us from FDA. And now I'll turn the call over to Dr. Frieden for opening remarks.
Good afternoon, everyone. Today, it's been 6 weeks to the day from CDC's first announcement and travel briefing about Zika. In these past 6 weeks, we've done a lot and we've learned a lot about this unprecedented situation. In fact, we're literally learning more about Zika every day. In this briefing, we have a lot of information to cover, so please bear with us. We're going to outline new findings and developments. For the American public, the bottom line hasn't changed from the time of our initial announcement. If you're pregnant, avoid travel to a place where Zika is spreading. If you're in a place such as Puerto Rico where Zika is spreading, do everything you can to avoid mosquito bites and also avoid risk of sexual transmission of Zika. The most serious risk in this outbreak is to pregnant women and to the developing fetus. In these past 6 weeks, there have been two anticipated developments and one unanticipated development. First, we anticipated that there would be continued rapid spread of the Zika virus in places where the mosquito species that spreads it lives, including Puerto Rico, and in fact, that is what we've seen. Second, we anticipated that there would be many, possibly hundreds or even thousands of American travelers returning from Zika-affected areas, and this, too, is what we're seeing. We did not, however, anticipate that we would see this many sexually transmitted cases of Zika. When sexual transmission in the current outbreak was first documented, we issued guidance indicating that men who live in or have returned from a Zika-affected area use a condom if they have sex with a woman who is pregnant. Today's report underscores the importance of that recommendation. As of today, 147 cases have been reported to CDC. Of these, 107 are travel-related cases in 24 states and the District of Columbia. The other 40 are mostly locally acquired infections in U.S. territories. Puerto Rico is by far the most affected area. It makes the numbers a little confusing, but I would like to indicate that today, after closure of the CDC numbers that I just mentioned for the whole country, including Puerto Rico from this past week, Puerto Rico posted their latest information, which indicates that they have so far 117 known diagnosed cases. CDC's response and that of other parts of the federal government, as well as other countries, is extensive. Today's briefing covers just a few aspects of this. One critical aspect is increasing access to diagnosis of infection with the virus. There are fundamentally two different types of tests for Zika. One tests for active infection. Another tests for infection at least a week up to several months after that infection. The CDC laboratory has developed tests for both of these and is rolling them out to laboratories in the CDC Laboratory Response Network, or LRN, over the next several weeks. The test for active infection can already be performed by more than 20 laboratories around the U.S. using CDC materials. These labs cover most of returning at-risk travelers, and returning travelers in other parts of the country can have their specimens sent to CDC. We'll hear more about testing shortly, but first, we'll hear from Dr. Denise Jameson about today's MMWR article, Zika virus infection among U.S. pregnant travelers, August 2015 to February 2016. This is important information, and even though the numbers are small, they're of considerable interest. We understand that the occurrence of fetal malformation, fetal loss, a miscarriage, or a child with a birth defect is something that can be devastating to a family. That's why we're working so hard to understand more what's happening and how it can be prevented. Dr. Jameson?
Thank you, Dr. Frieden, and good afternoon. After reports of microcephaly and other adverse pregnancy outcomes in women with Zika virus infection, CDC issued a travel alert on January 15, 2016. This advisory recommended that pregnant women consider postponing travel to areas with ongoing Zika virus transmission. Shortly thereafter, on January 19th, CDC released guidelines for U.S. healthcare providers who care for pregnant women who have traveled to an affected area. We updated those guidelines on February 5th to include women residing in areas with local Zika virus transmission and expanded our recommendations to offer testing to asymptomatic pregnant women with possible Zika virus exposure. As of February 17, 2016, 9 U.S. pregnant travelers with Zika virus infection had been reported to CDC. Among these women, there were no Zika virus-related hospitalizations or deaths. Among the 6 women with Zika virus disease who experienced symptoms during the first trimester, 2 women experienced spontaneous pregnancy losses, 2 women chose to undergo elective pregnancy termination, 1 woman delivered an infant with microcephaly, and 1 pregnancy is continuing without complications. 2 women with Zika virus disease were exposed during the second trimester of pregnancy, 1 delivered an apparently healthy infant, and the other pregnancy is continuing. The 1 confirmed case of Zika virus disease in a woman who was exposed during the third trimester of pregnancy resulted in the delivery of a healthy infant. All of the confirmed cases were among U.S. women who had traveled to areas with local Zika virus transmission, including American Samoa, Brazil, El Salvador, Guatemala, Haiti, Honduras, Mexico, Puerto Rico, and Samoa. To better understand the effects of Zika virus infection during pregnancy, CDC has established the U.S. Pregnancy Registry for Zika virus infection. This registry will provide information about the effects of Zika virus on pregnant women and their children. Information about the registry will soon be available on the CDC website. In addition, CDC maintains a 24/7 consultation service for health officials and healthcare providers caring for pregnant women with possible Zika virus infection. To contact this service, call 1-800-CDC-INFO or email zikamch@cdc.gov. And now Dr. Paul Mead will share the latest information about what we know about sexual transmission.
Thank you, Dr. Jameson, and good afternoon. Today we released a report in the MMWR about transmission of Zika virus through sexual contact with travelers to areas of active transmission. After we published CDC's interim guidance to help prevent sexual transmission of Zika virus on February 5, 2016, we and state health departments have received new reports of additional instances of possible sexual transmission of Zika virus. During February 6 through 22, 2016, roughly the 2 weeks after our recommendation, we received numerous reports of possible sexual transmission of Zika virus from multiple states. In conjunction with state and local health doctors, nurses, laboratory experts, and disease control specialists, we are investigating each of these reports. These investigations take time, not only to interview the patients for detailed information, but also to obtain laboratory samples and test them for Zika. The test that is most able to confirm the diagnosis of Zika requires actual growth of the virus in the laboratory, something which takes about a week. At this point, we are reporting on the 6 most advanced investigations, 2 laboratory-confirmed cases and 4 probable cases of Zika virus disease in women who had not traveled themselves and whose only known risk factor was sexual contact with a symptomatic male partner who had recently traveled to an area with ongoing Zika virus transmission. All 6 confirmed or probable cases occurred in women, including some who were pregnant. Median patient age was 22 years. In all cases where the type of sexual contact was documented, the contact included vaginal intercourse without a condom and occurred when the male partner was symptomatic or shortly after symptoms resolved. Please note that we are not releasing details of pregnancy status, age, state of residence of these patients out of respect for patient privacy and confidentiality, and we trust that you and the media will also respect patient privacy. While these additional investigations are being completed, CDC encourages state and local public health departments, clinicians, and the public to be aware of and to follow our recommendations for preventing sexual transmission of Zika virus. This is particularly important for men who have pregnant partners or for pregnant women. These recommendations advise pregnant women who have partners who live in or have traveled to Zika-affected areas to discuss the male partner's potential exposure and any history of Zika-like illness with their health care provider. Providers should consult CDC's guidelines for evaluation and testing of pregnant women, which are available on CDC's webpage. Men who reside in or have traveled to an area of active Zika virus transmission and who have a pregnant sex partner should use a condom during sex the right way every time or consider not having sex during the partner's pregnancy. Using latex condoms the right way every time reduces the risk of sexual transmission of many infections, including those caused by other viruses. Of note, all the women who were confirmed or likely to have transmitted in Zika in our investigations, all the men who were confirmed and likely to have transmitted Zika in our investigations so far have done so when they were ill or shortly after their illness resolved. This doesn't mean that transmission later on is impossible. It may be that we simply haven't seen this yet because spread of Zika is relatively recent. Studies to determine how long Zika remains in semen after illness are not completed and will likely take months to complete. These investigations are preliminary. CDC will continue to update its guidance as more information becomes available.
Thank you, Dr. Jameson and Dr. Mead. And now Dr. Julie Villanueva will provide information on the diagnostic test.
Thank you, Dr. Frieden. The CDC Zika IgM antibody capture enzyme-linked immunosorbent assay, or the Zika MAC ELISA, can detect proteins called antibodies that the human body makes to fight a Zika virus infection. These antibodies, in this case immunoglobulin M, or IgM, appear in the blood of a person infected with Zika virus beginning as early as 4 days after the start of illness and can last for several weeks. The Zika MAC ELISA can help determine whether a person may have been recently infected with Zika virus. This new test will be available in qualified U.S. public health laboratories through the LRN. The CDC was able to make the test available quickly because we worked very closely with our colleagues at the Food and Drug Administration using a special expedited process to authorize its use, called an Emergency Use Authorization, or EUA. An EUA is a tool that FDA can use to allow the use of certain medical products for emergencies based on scientific data. The U.S. Secretary of Health and Human Services has declared that circumstances exist to allow the emergency use of authorized diagnostic tests for Zika virus infection, such as the CDC Zika MAC ELISA. We're fortunate to have Dr. Borio from the FDA on the phone today to be available to answer any other questions you may have about the emergency use authorization process. Dr. Frieden?
Thank you very much, Dr. Villanueva. And I want to particularly thank Secretary Burwell of HHS, of the FDA, and our own lab team for having worked so hard to make this lab test available. This is a test that has been developed over years in the CDC laboratory, and over a question of just weeks, we've been able to scale up production with the support of the Secretary, Secretary Burwell, and the FDA, get through regulatory approvals, and we're now rolling this test out to laboratories throughout the United States. It will take time before it's widely available, and we've completed all of the quality assurance checks with all of the laboratories that are doing it, but it's an encouraging step forward. Before we take questions, I'd like to just spend a moment summarizing what we know now, what we don't know, and what we're doing. We know that Zika is spreading widely in parts of the world where the particular mosquito species is present, and we know that it's associated with a potentially devastating fetal malformation, microcephaly. We know that while at least while men are symptomatic, they can spread Zika to their sexual partners. We know that Zika and microcephaly are associated, although we do not yet have definitive proof that Zika infection alone is the cause of microcephaly, although the evidence for this is getting stronger by the day. We know that Guillain-Barré syndrome is very likely triggered by Zika in a small proportion of infections, as it is after a variety of other infections. And we know that, unfortunately, the mosquitoes that spread Zika are very hard to get rid of. The key is reducing the risk to pregnant women. That means reducing travel of pregnant women to areas where Zika is spreading. That means reducing the risk of sexual transmission of Zika. And that means trying to reduce the mosquito populations in areas where Zika is spreading. And this last is the hardest, because the particular mosquito that spreads Zika has been referred to as the cockroach of mosquitoes. It lives indoors in dark places. It's hard to get rid of. And efforts to do so have often been frustrated by the sheer numbers of the mosquito and the difficulty in getting rid of it. There are also many things we wish we knew and are working hard to find out. We don't know for sure that Zika infection causes microcephaly, and if it does, whether there are cofactors that make it more likely to do so. We don't know whether there's any phase of pregnancy in which infection is at lower or no risk for the fetus. We don't know if infants born without microcephaly will have any other health problems, and unfortunately, this is something we may not know for many years. We don't know if the prior finding that 80% of infections are asymptomatic will hold true in this outbreak. CDC's commitment to protecting Americans from health threats is absolute. It's why we're here. It's what makes the thousands of doctors, lab experts, disease control experts, and other scientists come to work every day. In Atlanta and throughout the U.S., including in Puerto Rico and the other affected U.S. territories, more than 600 CDC staff are working to continue to learn more and do more to protect people. CDC is one part of the U.S. government's overall response to Zika. Our friends at NIH are working hard on vaccines. FDA is doing tremendous work to get approvals quickly for diagnostic tests and other urgent tools. The President has asked Congress for $1.9 billion in emergency funding to enable us to further prepare for and respond to the Zika virus outbreak, both domestically and internationally. Of this, $828 million is intended for use by CDC to allow us to do more, including increasing lab capacities throughout the country, establishing rapid response teams to limit potential clusters of cases in the U.S., expanding monitoring systems so we can track what's happening, including Guillain-Barré syndrome, birth defects in the U.S. and our territories, increasing research into the link between Zika, microcephaly, and other health outcomes, providing targeted information for people who need it most, including pregnant women and healthcare providers, and most importantly, figuring out ways to reduce the risk of Zika. We're continuing to inform people about Zika and to learn more about the links between Zika and health outcomes. CDC has deployed 25 staff to assist in Puerto Rico, in addition to the 50 staff who work there year-round in our dengue branch. They're providing support, including investigation and monitoring for other Zika cases, assessing local mosquito populations for their susceptibility or resistance to different insecticides, and helping with mosquito control efforts. There is the potential for hundreds of thousands of Zika cases in Puerto Rico and potentially, tragically, a affected pregnancies as well. CDC is helping local teams there in any way we can. We're also working closely with public health teams in Brazil, tracking the spread of Zika virus and studying the links between Zika and microcephaly and other adverse birth outcomes. An HHS delegation just returned from Brazil, and another team of CDC experts is working in close partnership with Brazil on research and evaluation. Team members in Colombia are working to develop a detailed study of pregnant women who have been infected by the Zika virus. This will be a very important way for us to learn more over time. In addition, we're continuing work to help prevent Zika infection in places with ongoing transmission. Because there's no vaccine to prevent Zika, the best way to prevent it is to protect yourself and your family from mosquito bites and sexual transmission. That's particularly relevant in terms of mosquito bites only in areas where Zika is spreading. And in the U.S., that's currently only Puerto Rico, American Samoa, and the U.S. Virgin Islands, as far as information available to date. This is a challenge for some people right now, and for that reason, CDC has worked with the CDC Foundation to develop Zika prevention kits, or ZPKs. The ZPKs inform women about the Zika virus, its risks, and how to avoid infection. The kits provide pregnant women with an initial supply of prevention tools. The kits are not intended to take them through the entire pregnancy. Kits contain educational materials, mosquito repellent, condoms, a thermometer, tablets that can be put into standing water, that is, water that can't be eliminated, and prevent mosquitoes from hatching. Kits are being provided at no cost to women who need them in Puerto Rico, American Samoa, and the U.S. Virgin Islands. We'll be rolling out the distribution of these kits over the next several weeks, and they'll help women in areas of local Zika transmission learn more and do more to protect themselves and their pregnancy.
Thank you very much, Dr. Frieden, and our other speakers. Karen, we're now ready for questions.
Thank you. At this time, we'll start the question and answer session. If you would like to ask a question, please press star, then one. Our first question comes from Karen Weintraub of Stat News. Ma'am, your line is open.
Hi, thanks very much for taking my call. I was wondering, is there a line, is there a moment when we can say, yes, Zika does cause microcephaly or Guillain-Barré? Is there something that you're looking for or waiting for to make that decision?
Well, let's take them separately. In both cases, we have additional studies underway, and in terms of Guillain-Barré, we may well be learning more in the coming days and weeks. Microcephaly is more complicated because the question isn't only, is there an association? There's clearly an association. The question is also, is it absolutely causal, and are there any cofactors? What point in pregnancy is the highest risk period? Whether non-obviously affected children have any health effects. So there's a lot more that we still will be learning over the coming days, weeks, and months. And some of it will simply take time. For example, as women who were exposed more recently deliver infants, we may tragically find out that microcephaly is present in some of those infants.
And Guillain-Barré, is there something that specifically that you need to know in order to declare that causal?
There are studies underway, including one that we've done with Brazil, and when the laboratory work from that comes back, we may have more definitive information. But I would emphasize that it's really important to think of these two conditions differently. Guillain-Barré is something that we see after many different infections, including West Nile virus, which is related to Zika. So we would not be the least bit surprised if Guillain-Barré is definitely associated with Zika. And given the time course of clusters of Guillain-Barré after peaks of Zika virus infection, I think most epidemiologists who've looked at this would say that it's almost certainly related. In the case of microcephaly, it's much more complicated. This is an extraordinarily unusual occurrence. It has been more than 50 years since a pathogen causing microcephaly or other serious birth defects has been identified. And, in fact, we're not aware of any previous documentation of a mosquito-borne cause of an infection that can cause a severe birth defect such as microcephaly. So I think things do develop over time, and part of science is uncovering information step by step and trying to be sure to not overstate what the data shows, but also as soon as we have information, as we're doing today, to share that openly with the public.
Thank you.
Yes,
sir. Our next question comes from Maggie Fox of NBC News. Ma'am, your line is open.
Thanks very much. We're very confused about some of the numbers here. And can we go through some of the cases that we have already known about and reported on and what are new among the 9 pregnancies that you're reporting on? For instance, I believe the one case of the baby born with severe microcephaly must be referring to the case in Hawaii. And a couple of the miscarriages, are these the cases where CDC definitively linked Zika to microcephaly, please?
In our report out today, we are not linking any of the cases to specific states. We're just reporting that there were 9 pregnant travelers with Zika infection and then reporting on those cases by trimester. So I don't think I can comment on the states where these pregnant women are from.
You can understand where we might be confused, however, and where the numbers might start to get conflated. For purposes of clarity, can we say that the one case that's been delivered is one that we knew about and that the cases that were either aborted or miscarried have been described before?
Perhaps the confusion is this is the first time we've reported on U.S. pregnant travelers. The prior cases that CDC reported on were in Brazil.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Mike Stobie of the Associated Press. So your line is open.
Okay. Thanks for taking the call. I share Maggie's confusion and desire for clarity. But let me ask: of the nine pregnant women, were all U.S. citizens? And then I also had a question about the tests. Are you all saying that these are now going to be available in commercial labs? And what are the rates of false positives and false negatives for this test?
All right, that was a few questions. Let me first clarify the previous answer. So to Maggie Fox's question, a previous MMWR reported on 2 early infant deaths, infants who died in the first 24 hours of life with severe microcephaly, and on 2 miscarriages. That was a prior MMWR. All 4 of those were in Brazil, in Brazilian women. None of those 4 are reported in today's set of 9. CDC has not previously reported any of the 9. Some may have been in news media in various places. Diagnostic tests are currently going to be made available through the Laboratory Response Network. We are in conversation with several commercial entities about providing a non-exclusive license agreement to them to develop the test, and we're open to providing materials and information and technology transfer to other parts of the private sector, but our first priority is to make sure that public health departments throughout the United States have access to the tests. I'll ask Dr. Julie Villanueva to say anything more about the distribution of the virus as well as false positives and false negatives.
Thank you. So with any diagnostic assay, there's a risk of a false positive and a false negative. And when the FDA does post our instructions for use on their website, you'll be able to look at the performance characteristics of this test. If you have a positive result with the Zika macrolide, it's likely that you were recently infected with Zika virus. But there is a chance that the test can give a false positive result that is incorrect. This is because there are other very closely related flaviviruses such as dengue virus that can cause a positive result. And so those positive specimens will be sent to CDC or a laboratory designated by CDC for further confirmation.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question is coming from Betsy McKay of the Wall Street Journal. Ma'am, your line is open.
Thanks. Just to clarify, following up on Maggie and Mike, Dr. Frieden, I think what you were saying is this is the first time that CDC has reported since on any pregnant travelers, right? So and all of these nine include all cases that have been reported to CDC, whether they were reported in the media elsewhere first.
Correct.
So, okay, good. Thank you. Then I just wanted to ask a couple of questions or two about the pregnant the cases. Could you maybe, Dr. Jameson, describe for us where Zika was found in the cases of in the pregnancies of patients A and B? In other words, was it in amniotic fluid or placenta or elsewhere? It said it was in products of conception, I think. And then lastly, is CDC looking into the possibility that previous infection with dengue might be a factor for these women who also had Zika and have had babies born with microcephaly? Thanks. Sorry, lots of questions.
So in the early spontaneous abortion or early fetal loss, the products of conception were positive by PCR and immunohistochemistry. In the infant case, the placenta was positive by PCR and immunohistochemistry.
But what is products of conception? Could you just describe what that means for us?
Well, early in gestation, it's sometimes hard to differentiate what the different products are. In some cases, the fetus hasn't even begun developing. So just in general, the products from the conception were positive by PCR and immunohistochemistry, but we're not specifically stating which part of that early pregnancy loss was positive.
Does that answer your question? All right, next question.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Sabrina Tavernisi of New York Times. Ma'am, your line is open.
Hi, everybody. Thank you. I had Betsy to have you guys answered the placenta question, although in plain English, how would one render that product of just
tissue
or something?
So let's just be clear here. There are now a series of miscarriages among women who have been infected with Zika. As we did report earlier in the patients from Brazil, our laboratory identified Zika in the placental tissues there. So that is suggestive that Zika may have caused the miscarriage, but it's important to note that I believe 10 to 20% of all pregnancies may end in a spontaneous miscarriage. So the fact that it's present doesn't necessarily mean that it caused them. However, its presence in the placenta is certainly suggestive that it may have.
Got it. And could I ask one more question on the two that terminated? Was that because there were abnormalities and they decided to terminate, or do we know why they terminated?
We don't have information about how that personal decision was made. However, there were brain abnormalities noted on ultrasound and then on MRI in the case of the termination.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Dan Childs of ABC News. Sir, your line is open.
Thank you very much for taking my call. This addresses something that we've heard often about this virus, that infection is only present in terms of symptoms in 20% of people, that up to 4 out of 5 people who are infected may be asymptomatic. My question is, do you intend to study if asymptomatic men might be able to pass the infection, and likewise if asymptomatic pregnant women could still have a higher chance of giving birth to a child with microcephaly, considering that this could account for so many of the infections that are out there?
We wish we knew the answer to those questions, and we're studying that. They end up being quite difficult to study because you then have to test a large number of people without symptoms to identify the moment when infection may be present. So, yes, those are very important questions. Yes, we're investigating in them, but no, we don't have answers as of today, and it may take some time before we have answers.
Just one quick follow-up.
No one is more impatient than we are to get answers to these questions.
Just one quick follow-up. How would such a study be conducted, hypothetically?
So, for example, What we have done with chikungunya in Puerto Rico is to get blood from people who are donating blood and test it for the chikungunya virus. And that's how we determined that chikungunya had spread extremely quickly in Puerto Rico, that within just 8 or 9 months, about a quarter of the adult population had become infected with the chikungunya virus. And if you combine that with asking about symptoms, that you can then know how much asymptomatic infection there is, since you would have screened out those with symptoms or have a record of it. For the issue of asymptomatic women having a potential risk of transmission to the fetus, the studies that we're doing in Colombia have a good chance of identifying that, since we have women who have definitive infection with Zika. The problem is that they're all symptomatic. So, Dr. Jameson, do you want to say anything more about this topic?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. You'd have to enroll a cohort of pregnant women who were not symptomatic and follow them throughout their pregnancy, maybe testing them every month to find those who are infected and may not have symptoms.
The further complexity here, just to give you a sense of the challenges that our teams are working with, is that in the areas where Zika spreads, dengue and chikungunya are also present. And there is a lot of cross-reactivity, even with the best tests available in the world, that may make it difficult to differentiate one infection from the other. So these are very challenging studies to do, and something that we continue to work hard on.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Brady Dennis of Washington Post. Your line is open.
Oh, hi. Thank you guys for holding the call today. I'm sorry if I missed this. I heard an earlier question asked about whether the 9 pregnant women with Zika were all U.S. citizens or not, and if there was an answer, I missed it, so I just wanted to ask again. And also, I'm curious if you could talk a little bit, Dr. Frieden or anyone else, about given the worries of pregnant women in this situation, what we know and perhaps don't know about how early in pregnancy you might be able to detect, potential brain abnormalities or other problems. What do we know about that, and what are we learning about that? Thank you.
So regarding the 9 pregnant women, they were all U.S. travelers. So I can't comment on their citizenship, but they were all women who reside in the U.S. and traveled to a place with ongoing Zika virus transmission.
So it's okay to say they're all U.S. residents, essentially.
U.S. travelers.
They all live here. Okay, got it.
In terms of how soon we can detect these abnormalities, in terms of microcephaly can be hard to detect on ultrasound early on, so it's possible to see abnormalities at 18 any weeks of gestation, but it's not very reliable for picking up these abnormalities early on. The later in pregnancy, the easier it is to see the abnormalities of the skull and brain. However, it's not clear whether these abnormalities develop later on, and that's why you don't see them at 18 to 20 weeks, for example, when many women receive a routine screening ultrasound, or whether we're just not very good at picking them up earlier on. And
okay.
So there's still a lot we don't know about when Zika has an effect and when we can first detect these effects, and we are studying these issues.
And I'm sorry, that was Denise?
Yes.
Okay, thanks so much.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Amy Birnbaum of CBS News. Ma'am, your line is open.
To clarify a couple of things, you noted brain abnormalities were noted on the ultrasound and those that were terminated. That was for both, because the case report just has the one. That's one question. And then I also wanted to ask about, in terms of the sexual transmission, you mentioned a few cases of sexual transmission for women who are pregnant. Did you give a number? And then finally, I want to ask the FDA about progress on a test for the blood supply. Thank you so much.
So the first question regarding terminations, we only reported the results for one of the terminations that, again, had the brain abnormalities on ultrasound and MRI. There are no additional details about the other terminations.
We're about 45 minutes into this call, and I believe that FDA had to drop off the call, so I would have to refer you to their office for further questions.
Thank you. And then if you could just clarify the sexual transmission in pregnancy, if they need.
I assume you're referring to the number of cases, and several of the patients were pregnant. However, we're not releasing the details of those, again, out of respect for patient confidentiality.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Maren McKenna of National Geographic. Your line is open.
Hi, thanks very much. This is another request for a little more clarity in the numbers, please. So in the discussion of pregnancies, you have 9 lab-confirmed pregnancies among travelers. You have 10 additional reports of pregnancies that you're following up on. And we also have a separate set of cases of confirmed or probable sexual transmission. Do those two sets of patients overlap? In other words, are some of those pregnancies that you are investigating cases of sexual transmission?
No, because the case series of pregnant women are just travelers, women who traveled and were exposed in those countries with ongoing or areas with ongoing Zika virus transmission. So they do not include pregnant women who may have been exposed sexually. They're non-overlapping.
That includes the 10 that you're following up on, because it says 10 pregnant women, not 10 travelers.
That's correct.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Robert Loves of Medscape Medical News. Sir, your line is open.
Yes, thanks for taking my call. I see a news report that the Oregon Health Authority says that Oregon has its first case of the Zika virus that was spread by sexual transmission. Is this case part of what has been reported today, or is this an additional case?
Yeah. Again, this is Paul Mead. I think that I'd need to refer you back to Oregon for that information. I think our approach here is to respect the states that have asked us to keep that sort of information private for now. Thank you.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Lynn Peterson of Trends in Medicine. Your line is open.
Thank you. So given that the Brazilians apparently markedly undercounted microcephaly before 2015, how much does the current observed rate of cases exceed the expected number? Because I think there are cases of microcephaly without Zika. And so given the birth rate and the known rates of microcephaly elsewhere, is the number really excessive? And what about here in the U.S. as well?
The numbers here are small in the United States, so we do have good baseline data here for the rate of microcephaly, and microcephaly does occur for lots of different reasons. But we did not expect to see these brain abnormalities in this small case series of U.S. pregnant travelers. So it is unexpected and greater than we would have expected.
Thank you. We'll take one more question.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Dan Vergano of BuzzFeed News. So your line is open.
Thanks, folks. I was wondering, can you do a little more to put that in perspective? I mean, if we report to people that you had 9 pregnant travelers and I think 2 miscarriages, 2 terminations with brain abnormalities, a case of microcephaly on delivery, that's like 5 out of 9. I mean, should people take that as the rate of problems after a Zika infection in pregnancy? Or if not, then you should tell us and put it in perspective.
No, we just don't know. It's too soon to say. We're providing information as it becomes available, and there is important information in this case series. For example, If you look at the numbers of women known to have been infected in the first trimester of pregnancy, two had miscarriages, one had a child with microcephaly, and one has an ongoing pregnancy, and two had voluntary terminations of pregnancy. So the first trimester, we would expect from rubella, a parallel experience, might be a period of higher risk. But what proportion of all women infected have their fetus develop a problem, that can only be done with large-scale studies such as those that we have teams on the ground doing today in both Brazil and Colombia. So I want to first thank everyone for participating in this briefing, and I want to recap and mention a couple of the really key issues. I want to close by coming back to the bottom line. For most people in the U.S., the bottom line is that pregnant women should postpone travel to Zika-affected areas. As we get more reports of confirmed sexual transmission of the Zika virus, we strongly encourage pregnant women and their male partner who's traveled to or lives in an area where Zika is spreading to use protection with condoms if they have sex. Third, pregnant women who themselves have traveled to an area where Zika has been spreading should and can now be tested for the virus between 2 and 12 weeks after return. We continue to learn more about Zika every day, and we're developing new tools to help diagnose it. There's something that everyone can do. Pregnant women can defer travel or, if they live in a Zika-affected area, do their best to avoid mosquito bites. Communities can reduce mosquito populations by mosquito control and investing in effective mosquito control strategies. We at CDC and throughout HHS and the rest of the federal government are working 24/7 to scale up testing for Zika, track the virus, implement the best ways we have today to protect people, and figure out better ways to kill mosquitoes and prevent Zika. We are committed to telling people what we know when we know it, and as always, when we learn more, we'll share it so Americans can decide best how to protect their own health. Thank you very much.
Thank you to all of our speakers and to Karen, our operator. This concludes our telebriefing. A transcript of this call will be posted to the CDC newsroom as soon as possible. If you need additional or information or have other questions, please call the CDC press office at 404-639-3286 or email us at media@cdc.gov. You can also find information in the two MMWR articles that were published today. Thank you very much.